All rise. The Supreme Court for the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Stiglitz presiding.
Good afternoon. Everyone go ahead and be seated. Case number 79658, 80113, 80968, Valley Health v. Murray. Senior Justices Cherry and Silver are sitting on this matter in the stead of Justice Kadish and Justice Lee, who are disqualified. Justice Cherry is down south. He's live. Justice Silver is to my right, and she's live, Lee. So, will counsel, you ready to get started? All right.
Smith, on behalf of Appellant Centennial Hills, with me is my co-counsel, Kendall Hanks. I'll try and reserve about 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Chief Justice, and may it please the court, this state has historically struggled with finding the democratic balance between, on the one hand, ensuring access to quality and affordable health care for all Nevadans, and on the other hand, ensuring adequate compensation for injured medical plaintiffs. Before 2002, that balance was out of whack. Exorbitant medical malpractice awards were driving doctors from the state, provider insurance premiums were skyrocketing 300 to 500%, and the state's only level one trauma center at UMC closed down. But the democratic process sprang into action. Then Governor Ginn called a special session of the legislature and enacted the state's first medical malpractice reforms. Just 2 years later, the voters themselves voiced their opinion and overwhelmingly passed the Keep Our Doctors in Nevada initiative. And the legislature has remained active in this area since, with periodic amendments like in 2015, and just this past legislative session with the compromise in AB 404 to slowly raise the non-economic damage cap over time. The legislature and the voters have taken a scalpel approach to fine-tuning those competing interests. But if the district court's newfound breach of fiduciary duty claim outside of Chapter 41A is allowed to stand, the last two decades of legislative efforts will be judicially abrogated. This court's entire jurisprudence about medical malpractice and professional negligence will be displaced with a new species of medical breach of fiduciary duty claim. The bad old days from 2002 will come roaring back, and ultimately healthcare will be less available and affordable for all of us. The district court should be reversed, therefore, for at least three reasons. First, the gravamen, essence, or substantial point of the Murray's novel legal theory involves medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. It's therefore covered by Chapter 41A, no matter the label that's attached to it. Second, Chapter 41A's damage caps and several liability provisions apply, and under those provisions, the Murrays are entitled to $1.339 million in compensatory damages based on professional negligence only. And finally, the punitive damage award should be reduced or vacated because it lacks substantial evidence, the jury was improperly instructed, and its computation conflicts with the plain language of the wrongful death statute and Chapter 42. On my first point, this court has never held that hospitals owe a standalone fiduciary duty to patients. My friends,
Mr. Smith, let me ask you a question about that, though, because this court has found that there's a fiduciary duty between a doctor and a patient. So how is a hospital different? Is somebody going into the hospital is arguably more vulnerable and completely reliant on the staff and the hospital policies for their health care, as opposed to somebody who's maybe seeing a doctor in an outpatient setting?
Certainly. So this court in the Hoops decision, which I think Your Honor is referencing, has recognized there are elements of a fiduciary relationship between a doctor and a patient based on trust and confidence and things of that nature. But this court has never held that there's a standalone breach of fiduciary duty claim, even vis-a-vis doctors. In fact, the Hoops decision was saying the opposite. If you look at 432 of that opinion, what this court said on 432 was that claims of sexual exploitation could be brought as part of a malpractice claim. So even Hoops was recognizing those egregious facts could be brought under a malpractice theory depending on the circumstances. Now, of course, this court also went out of its way to acknowledge, well, there was no evidence that the relationship there had a therapeutic benefit, etc. But even Hoops was recognizing that there could be a claim on those egregious facts as part of malpractice. So this court has never recognized a standalone breach of fiduciary duty claim between patients and hospitals.
So there's not a trust and confidence relationship between a patient and the hospital?
No, Your Honor. There are certainly elements of trust and confidence in that relationship, but those elements do not give rise to a separate standalone cause of action. And courts that have addressed that decision, I'd point the court to the Hales decision from Arizona. Same thing. It recognized that there are elements of trust and confidence between doctors and patients, but not a separate breach of fiduciary duty. Same with the Need decision out of Illinois. Same thing. And then the Garcia decision out of New Mexico. All recognized that there are elements of trust and confidence between doctors, but that does not mean there's a separate fiduciary duty. In Nevada, the legislature has outlined the duties of providers of health care. And by statute, Chapter 41A, hospitals, like all health care providers, only have a duty to exercise reasonable care, skill, or knowledge ordinarily used under similar circumstances. And this court has employed what is now a familiar test when determining whether Chapter 41A applies. The court looks to the gravamen, essence, or substantial point of the claim to determine whether it relates to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. And here, look no farther than the district court's decision. At 6788 of the record, the district court described this new medical breach of fiduciary duty like this. The district court said patients walk into hospitals expecting to be cared for, treated, and helped, and this creates a position of trust. So the district court couldn't avoid describing this new medical breach of fiduciary duty in terms of care at a hospital, treatment at a hospital, and patients in a hospital, which is already covered by Chapter 41A. Chapter 41A establishes the duties of healthcare providers, not separate sets of duties, particularly on these facts. And other courts that have applied the gravamen analysis, like this court does, and I'd point the court to the Minnesota Supreme Court and DAB versus Brown, again, the Need decision from Illinois, those courts that apply a gravamen type analysis have all held that just because you inject financial incentive allegations or profit motive allegations into the action, that doesn't change the nature of it. Your injury still flows, those courts say, from the therapeutic relationship between doctors and patients. The conduct you're ultimately complaining about stems from treatment. And this court, in a different context, employed that same mode of analysis in the Curtis decision by Justice Silver. 354 of that decision described Curtis like this, saying, if the underlying negligence had not caused Curtis's death, there'd be no factual basis to hold the facility liable for budgeting and staffing. In other words, what this court was saying, budgeting and staffing standing alone didn't cause Curtis, in that case, his injury, that you had to have negligent medical treatment in order to cause an injury, to have a mechanism to even raise the budgeting and staffing concerns. That is the same here. Without the too frequent or excessive administration of the drug, there'd be no basis to challenge the medication administration procedure, which is why I think the jury verdict form was structured the way that it was. The jury verdict form told the jury that if you answer no to the standard of care and causation questions 1 and 2, you don't even need to reach questions 9 and 10 about breach of fiduciary duty. That shows you that the breach of fiduciary duty claim was inextricably intertwined with the plaintiff's professional negligence claim. If there was no finding of professional negligence, you don't even reach the breach of fiduciary duty claim. And here, separate and apart from the legal issues, problems with this claim, because it involves the medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment, ultimately, care at a hospital, administration of medication by nurses, prescribed by doctors, overseen by a pharmacist. The facts of this case are quintessentially involved medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. And there's just no evidence of any profit motive either in the creation of the medication administration policy or in its implementation. Recall, the district court found not once but twice that there was no evidence of understaffing. But that was the plaintiff's grand theory at trial, was that having this medication administration procedure allowed the hospital to have fewer nurses. But the district court simultaneously found there was no evidence of understaffing. So those two findings by the district court are completely irreconcilable. If the profit motive was you could have fewer nurses, but the district court found that you had sufficient nurses, or at least there was no expert evidence of a deficiency in nurses, the profit motive that allegedly the plaintiffs were advancing didn't actually exist in fact. And while there was no evidence of actual understaffing, there was overwhelming evidence that the medication administration procedure was in fact the product of medical judgment. Yes, the policy, as the evidence came in, yes, the policy originally came from UHS, but there was testimony from Nursing Director Jones, Pharmacy Director Jackson, about how when the policy came to Centennial, it was reviewed by pharmacy committees, it was reviewed by medical staff. For example, at 3234 of the record, Pharmacy Director Jackson testified the policy was approved by medical staff. He explained how it went through different committees. They could make revisions, they could make additions, make subtractions. That testimony is in the record at 3255 to 58. Nursing Director Jones testified similarly about how the policy had approved it. They could make changes. That's at 2334. And she had some also colorful testimony that I think really illustrates the point. Nursing Director Jones at 2339 to 40 said things like, oh, this policy has nothing to do with profits. You just don't have to give the medication on the dot. And she testified it wasn't as if it was somebody from Florida telling us what we had to do. The policy came to Centennial, they reviewed it, it was approved by medical staff, it was the product of medical judgment, and they had the ability to add Toradol to the time critical list or not add Toradol to the time critical list. And the jury found that that failure to do so may have been negligent, but that isn't a separate basis for a breach of fiduciary duty claim. The other issue that the plaintiffs advance is this dichotomy between, well, this is an intentional tort. But simply calling a tort an intentional tort doesn't take it outside Chapter 41A. An intentional tort that relates to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment is still covered by Chapter 41A. And I'd point the court to Justice Cherry's decision from 2009 in Fearley. At footnote 8 of Fearley, this court noted that the definition of medical malpractice doesn't differentiate between intentional and negligent causes of action. And that makes sense when you think about it in terms of medical battery, right? What might be a battery in one context, if you've consented to treatment, is not a battery or an intentional tort in another context. The court has said that in Humboldt General Hospital and many other cases. I think Schwartz is, I recognize Schwartz is unpublished, but I think it's a good example where there the plaintiff was advancing an intentional tort for conspiracy. And this court said, well, you're still going to have to prove an underlying act of malpractice in order to prove your intentional conspiracy claim. So simply calling a claim an intentional tort does not take it outside Chapter 41A, particularly when it relates to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. And because the breach of fiduciary duty claim, even if a separate cause of action exists, and I don't think it does, but even if there's a separate claim, both the professional negligence claim and this breach of fiduciary duty claim are covered by Chapter 41A. So that brings me to my second point about the applicability of the damage caps and several liability provisions. The both Chapter 41A, 035, and 045 say that they apply in an action against a provider of health care, or in an action for injury or death against a provider of health care. And last sentence now says, regardless of the number of plaintiffs, defendants, or theories upon which liability is based. But as this court said in TAM, that qualification had always been the law. So no matter how many claims you have, and here they're advancing two, the cap applies per action and applies to both separate sets of claims. And so applying 41A, 035, the math looks a little bit like this. I'll try and explain it. There's also a chart that I think is helpful in our lower court briefs at 5625 that visualizes our math here. But this is how the math should work under 41A, 035. So there are three categories here of non-economic damages: loss of consortium, comfort, companionship, past and future grief and sorrow. And that phrase, past and future, is relevant to the prejudgment interest issue. But for now, past and future grief and sorrow, and then pain and suffering of the decedent related to negligence. And those three combined equal about $14.5 million. But because the damage cap applies, those get reduced to $350. Then we need to take into account the percentage of liability attributed to Centennial, which is 65%. So 65% of $350 is $227,500. And then we apply that same math effectively to the economic damages, which are not capped, but are $1.7 million. You apply the 65% proportionate fault. That's 1.1. So the total of compensatory damages to the heirs in the estate under professional negligence theory is $1.339 million. That's what the heirs in the estate are entitled to. And on appeal, the court will note we're not contesting the professional negligence findings by the jury. So 1.339 is the appropriate amount of compensatory awards. And finally, on my last point, with regard to punitive damages, as an initial matter, punitive damages were contingent on the jury verdict form based on the finding of breach of fiduciary duty. The jury was told that if you answer no to 9 and 10 about breach of fiduciary duty, you don't need to reach question 11 about punitive damages. So if this court properly enters judgment against breach of fiduciary duty, the court doesn't need to reach the question of punitive damages. So punitive damages are not available based on the lack of a viable cause of action for breach of fiduciary duty. Secondly, punitive damages aren't available for professional negligence or should be capped as non-economic damages. When the voters repealed and coded 41A.031, the voters closed loopholes that had exceptions to that cap that sound a lot like the current punitive damage standard. So I don't think punitive damages are available, or if they are, they're covered as non-economic damages under the definition of non-economic damages in 41A.011, which has that catch-all provision about other non-pecuniary damages. On pages 49 to 50 of our opening brief, we cite a number of cases that hold that punitive damages are a type of non-pecuniary damage. So I think as a legal matter, punitive damages aren't available. If the Murrays can surmount those legal problems, they also run into the lack of evidence at trial. There is simply not substantial evidence to support any clear and convincing evidence standard of fraud, oppression, or malice. The leading case on this is the Fitchner case, which the Murrays don't cite or address. And Fitchner says you have to have a culpable state of mind, not negligence, not just recklessness, but a culpable state of mind. And there's no evidence here that the nurses or anybody approving the medication administration procedure had a culpable state of mind with regard to Ms. Murray. And that's what they had to prove. Jury instruction 38 told the jury that the plaintiffs had to prove intentional exploitation of Ms. Murray for their gain and benefit. And there's no evidence of any intentional exploitation of Ms. Murray for the defendant's gain or benefit. Just no evidence of that. What we have is evidence of nurses trying to help a critically sick patient, and they may have done that negligently, but there's no evidence of fraud, oppression, or malice.
Mr. Smith, do you think the pleadings were adequate to raise the issue of punitive damages?
I don't, Your Honor. What the jury ultimately found, or what the district court ultimately upheld the punitive damage finding on, was breach of fiduciary duty related to the medication administration procedure, and the medication administration procedure wasn't alleged in the complaint. So under Sprouse versus Wentz, I think punitive damages were awarded based on a claim that didn't exist. And I acknowledge that the medication administration procedure was produced after the motion to amend hearing. I acknowledge that. But it was still produced 3 years before trial. And there was no amendment after it was produced. No expert supplemented their expert report to discuss the medication administration procedure. And those experts did other supplemental reports that are in the record here. But no supplement that was produced addressed the medication administration procedure. And there was ample time in the 3 years between when it was produced and trial, that if the experts were going to offer an opinion about the medication administration procedure, they had ample opportunity to do that. There's also an instructional error on the punitive damage award, which is there's a contradiction between jury instruction 48 and question 11. Jury instruction 48 properly referenced 42007 about corporate ratification for punitive damages, requiring that an officer, director, or managing agent approve the alleged wrongful conduct. But question 11 allowed the jury to find punitive damages only if an employee acted with fraud, oppression, or malice. So one instruction is referencing managing agents and officers. The other one is telling the jury it's enough if there's an employee.
Was this the hospital's verdict form?
No, Your Honor. The hospital objected to all punitive damage instructions. So the defense didn't offer any punitive damage instruction, and so...
No, I think maybe I didn't ask that correctly. Didn't the hospital supply this verdict form that was used? I thought that there was a verdict form that had been suggested by the plaintiff that was rejected in favor of the hospital's verdict form.
I believe Your Honor is referring to the damages portion. The plaintiffs proposed a verdict form that had two separate lines for the same damages, one line related to breach of fiduciary duty, one line to professional negligence. The defense objected to having duplicative damage lines for what is effectively the same injury and same damages. So in that regard, the defense's objection won out because there's only one set of lines for that. But overall, that was I think the only dispute about the form of the verdict form. And here, because one was saying employees, one was saying officer, director, managing agent, this isn't a scenario where an element is missing and we can read them together. It's a scenario where the jury instruction and the jury verdict form and the instruction were pointing in opposite directions. And finally, I want to address, if punitive damages are available, I do want to address how the district court's calculation conflicts with the plain language of the wrongful death statute. Chapter 41085, which is the wrongful death statute, creates two separate sets of claims, one for the heirs, one for the estate, and only the estate is entitled to punitive damages. The heirs get different categories, but the estate gets damages, special damages for medical expenses and funeral expenses, and then penalties as if she had lived. Because only the estate is entitled to punitive damages, the punitive damages can only be calculated based upon the categories that belong to the estate, including the heirs' categories of damages and the calculation of punitive damages that belong to the estate would violate due process. You're including categories that don't belong to the party entitled to punitives and ultimately punishing Centennial with categories of damages that belong to somebody else. And so if...
How would we, under 410855B, the estate can get penalties, including punitive damages, that the decedent would have got if they had lived. How does that enter into the calculus of what the estate can ultimately get?
Certainly, and I think that phrase, as if she had lived, is just referencing the fact that at common law, there is no right to punitive damages. At common law, there is no right, there is no cause of action for wrongful death. So what that phrase is saying is you, the estate, are allowed to get punitives as if you would if you'd lived. But that doesn't mean you get all the other categories. And that's what the plaintiffs are trying to get the court to adopt, is some alternate reality where we have one foot in this realm where the decedent is passed, so there's punitives, but you somehow count the heirs categories. But if we pretend like the estate is kind of alive, then the decedent's kind of alive. There is no past and future grief and sorrow. There is no loss of consortium comfort companionship. There is no loss of probable support. The only category that might be available, if we pretend as if the decedent is alive, is the $2.5 million for past pain and suffering for the decedent. But in this alternate reality, you also wouldn't have any funeral expenses for the estate. So I don't think, as a textual matter, we can kind of pretend like the estate that the estate gets the heir's damages. I think both on the plain language of the statute and due process requires that punitive damages, if they're available at all, be limited to being calculated based upon the categories that belong to the estate. And that would be that $10,000 figure under the $10,000 figure under funeral expenses, of course, reduced by 65%, and then the calculation based on that. One final point there. I understand that under 42005, when you receive a judgment less than $100,000, you could get up to $300,000 in punitive damages. But if you properly calculate the estate's damages based on only its injuries, its categories, $300,000 to what is $6,500 is a 46 times multiplier. And that may very well run into due process problems under State Farm at the U.S. Supreme Court and Bongiovi from this court. And I'll reserve the rest of my time unless the court has questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Stiglitz, and may it please the court. Abraham Smith for respondent. And I'll be taking about 15 minutes, and Mr. Polsenberger will be taking the remainder. In fact, Mr. Polsenberger is going to address the issues with the punitive damages and how to allocate that and reconcile that with the wrongful death statute. But I do have to point out that the plain language of 41085 is clear on its face that the estate is entitled to the punitive damages that the decedent would have received if she had lived. Right. So I think it strains credulity to say that the punitive damages would be capped at three times funeral expenses in the or in the case of the State Farm single-digit ratio analysis. That,
practically, though, I mean, if the decedent lives, can't we kind of assume that the jury might have a different view of the nature to punish the defendant versus if the decedent obviously is a decedent? Such that it would be very difficult to say, oh, let's go back and pretend she was alive and say this award is okay. The award is premised on punishing the defendant because somebody died based on their alleged negligence.
Well, it's based on the defendant's conduct, not based on the compensation to the individual plaintiff or decedent, right? So if the defendant's conduct is the same, then the punishment should be the same whether or not the decedent lives or not. The defendant shouldn't get a reprieve simply because they managed to kill the decedent rather than simply injure them.
The state had a survivorship claim under 41-100, and I recognize this isn't brief, but it caught my eye. Then the estate would have been entitled to recover punitive damages on a larger measure.
Without, if 41-085 didn't exist.
The survivorship claim?
Right. Well, and that actually gets to the other point, which is loss of consortium. That claim, of course, exists regardless of the presence or absence of a death.
Okay.
Right. So if the decedent had lived, there would still be a loss of consortium, or there could still be a loss of consortium claim to the spouse, depending on the injuries. Right. And that doesn't go away in the spouse, just as the plaintiff, if the plaintiff had lived, right, could have still. Both obtained potentially punitive damages on the basis of those claims if the decedent had lived. The spouse would have their own claim and the decedent would have their own claim. Once the decedent dies, then we're within the realm of the wrongful death statute. But I think it would be absurd to say that even though the statute says the estate can recover punitive damages as though the decedent had lived, that in fact we're just limited to some calculation based on funeral expenses. Let me go back to what I expect is the crux of this case, which is the fiduciary duty claim. Mr. Smith, the other Mr. Smith, brought up the Hoops versus Hammergren case, which I do think is interesting. And I was waiting to see how they would address that, whether they would say under today's statute or rather the statute that was in effect at the time of Ms. Murray's death, whether Ms. Hoops would have had a remedy in breach of fiduciary duty or whether she, too, would have been capped by the medical malpractice cap and the several liability provisions of 41A. And I didn't get a totally clear answer, but it sounds like they're coming down on the side of, yes, this would still be ordinary or this would still be medical malpractice rather than a true breach of fiduciary duty or ordinary negligence outside the realm of medical malpractice. and I think that that's rather irreconcilable with the development, this court's development of the 41A jurisprudence. So if Hoops had come before the court today, how would the court look at this? According to Centennial, we would still have a problem at the duty, right? According to Centennial, the legislature has codified the scope of a hospital's duty to patients in its care. That's at their opening brief, page 23. Well, if that's true, then Dr. Hammergren would only have had a duty in providing services. And in fact, this court in DeBoer has said that that's not the only duty that a hospital has. There can be, in other contexts, additional duties that a hospital has. And we also have to look at the context. So in Hammergren, Centennial says that the alleged fiduciary duty could arise solely from the patient, provider-patient relationship and is substantially related to medical treatment. But that would have been true in Hammergren as well. Indeed, Ms. Hoops perceived it necessary to continue with her relationship with Dr. Hammergren in order to continue treatment. And this court in Curtis has also made clear that there is that you can have common law duties of ordinary negligence, for example, that coexist with duties relating to professional negligence, even if it occurs within the course of treatment. And then there's the issue of separate acts. Centennial claims that you can't separate the policy, in this case the medication administration policy, from the nurse's or the doctor's conduct. But in Hammergren, there was the same issue, right? You had a series of allegations, some like the claim for mistreatment that involved the dosing of particular drugs that sounded an ordinary malpractice, and then the other claim relating to the sexual advantage that sounded in a breach of fiduciary duty. And this court, in both in Szymborski and in Curtis, have made clear that you have to look at those acts separately, even if those acts cause the same damage. In Szymborski, for example, there were claims both of professional negligence and ordinary negligence, both of which led to the property damage at Mr. Szymborski's house. And in Curtis, you had both the ordinary negligence of the nurse providing morphine that was intended for another patient, and the professional negligence of failing to monitor Ms. Curtis after the procedure, after that administration, that combined to lead to Ms. Curtis's death. And though this court has had no trouble disentangling those, right, you would still be able to go to a jury on those issues and have the court and have the jury decide whether Ms. Curtis's injuries, to what extent they were caused by the administration of the morphine, and to what extent they were caused.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Looking at Hoops and looking at this case on case-by-case basis, looking at the facts in this case, how are they even the least bit similar to Hoops? What is the conduct here? Tell me what's the conduct here that makes it so similar to Hoops.
You've got, so you have a hospital holding company, UHS, that provides a policy to Centennial Hills. And I understand there's a conflict in the evidence, and Mr. Jordan cited the evidence or the testimony that yes, this did undergo medical review. But there's also evidence that perhaps this did not undergo a medical review. In other words, there was not a medical judgment made with respect to the adoption of
that
policy.
What's the evidence of that in the record?
Yeah. So at page volume 38, apologize. Pages 7796 and 7798, we had examples of the hospital's other policies that related to treatment, including the reporting of critical lab values. And each of those policies showed how exactly they were reviewed and who at Centennial had reviewed and approved those policies. And each of those policies were approved specifically by the medical director.
Where was the evidence in the record that this policy was put in place for profits over patient safety?
So I think Judge Bluth got it correct when she referenced the testimony of their expert, Nurse Waldron, and also Director Jones, the nursing director, and Director Jackson, where they talked about if you had a policy in place that didn't override the doctor's judgment and didn't override the black box warning, that indeed it would require the hospital to hire more nurses. In fact, Nurse Waldron says that you would have to have effectively a one-to-one patient ratio, and they were never going to do that. Now, we dispute that's the necessary consequence of adopting a policy that would have complied with the black box warning here, but nevertheless, that was Centennial's position, that it would have required the hospital to hire more nurses. In other words, as an administrative or a business decision.
Let me ask you a question about Judge Bluth's order, because I'm troubled and not understanding how we got from order one to order two and what occurred. Because in order two, Judge Bluth says, hey, in that first order, I really narrowed my focus to the understaffing issues. Now I'm going to address medication administration policy. And I'm going to find that after a deep dive into trial transcripts, a jury could have found liability on breach of fiduciary duty. But in order one, she addressed medication and administration policy on multiple occasions. And in particular, on page 13, she notes that in order to determine whether the conduct was professional negligence or an intentional tort, I have to take a dive into the trial transcripts and find what testimony and evidence was presented to see if defendant intentionally understaffed and or created a medication policy due to the hospital's business goals, desires, and or profit. Very next sentence, the court found no record of any evidence that established intentional conduct on behalf of defendant. So I don't see how she can make what I view as a 180-degree opposite finding in that second order, that I've looked at the same evidence without some type of, look, we've all been there at district court, some type of acknowledgement of reconsideration and I misinterpreted things or there's cases that I needed to review or maybe there were facts that I wasn't aware of. She just kind of completely flip-flopped.
So I think she did acknowledge in the second order that she reviewed all of the trial testimony, all the transcripts. Yeah, I agree with
you. Said that in the first order.
She said that she
reviewed all of that.
Right. But look at what she points to. I mean, she cites specific testimony from both our experts, Dr. DeBom and Dr. Schwimmer, and also also Centennial's experts, Nurse Waldron and their own nursing director and pharmacy director. And I think the change happened when she understood that it wasn't the province of the court to forbid the jury from drawing inferences from the evidence that was presented, right? And so when she may have, if she were coming at it fresh, perhaps she would have reached a different decision. But when there's evidence in the record that yes, this would have caused a cost to Centennial Hospital in order to implement a policy that didn't override the doctor's judgment, and that it would result in them having to hire more nurses, I think the jury can draw the conclusion that it was for that business purpose that they adopted this policy, especially when you have Dr. Arora at in his testimony where he talks about the failure of the hospital to alert him to this policy. He says, I've never seen this policy before. Did you know that the nurses under this policy, when you said that you were giving a Toradol at 6-hour intervals, that the nurses could violate the black box warning and dose up to an hour before, which resulted in Ms. Murray receiving 5 doses rather than 4 doses within a 24-hour period. He said he didn't, because this policy was not communicated to him. So not only did it override his medical judgment and, of course, the FDA's black box warning, but it didn't even inform him of that fact. And the fact is the hospital said, well, he could have written a more specific order. But that's a factual issue that the jury was entitled to find that, no, if Centennial Hills has this policy, it, number one, needs to undergo a medical review the way the other hospital, the way the other policies have, and it needs to be congruent with the doctor's own orders and with the FDA black box warning.
Mr. Smith, do you think the jury was entitled to find that when those facts were not contained in the breach of fiduciary duty claim in the amended complaint?
Yes. And for one thing, as I think Mr. Smith already conceded, the hospital's policy was itself disclosed after the initial expert report deadline, after our motion to amend the complaint had been heard and orally granted by Judge Baer. Yes. So at that point, Centennial was on notice of a breach of fiduciary duty claim. And I think they're right that it's ultimately a matter for the court to determine whether this policy constitutes a breach of fiduciary duty versus professional negligence. And they were aware that we were critical of how the administration of Toradol violated the black box warning. So when they produced this policy, they would have known that we were going to be critical of that policy.
Was there ever an attempt by the plaintiff to amend the complaint again?
No, there was not another amendment to the complaint. I mean, obviously under 15B, the court can amend the pleadings to conform to the evidence. And obviously the evidence was presented, including through testimony that Centennial itself elicited, right? Part of the issue was we had our experts, including Dr. DeBon, just criticizing the fact of the Toradol administration. Now, I feel like the jury still could have drawn that inference. But then when defense counsel got up and cross-examined him, he cross-examined him with information about the medication administration policy. Of course, Dr. DeBon, when that door was open, said, well, if that's the policy, then yes, that is also a violation, right? You can't have a policy that allows that, and it's not even, I mean, it's certainly not medical treatment or diagnosis, right? Because this is ex ante. This is before anybody knows anything about Ms. Murray.
What is your response to appellant's reply that you should have pled it with particularity under Rule 9?
So it's not technically a fraud claim. I mean, in the way that if you're asking for punitive damages, you wouldn't have to plead punitive damages with particularity. It is, I think we analogize to fraud, but the nature of the duty arises from exactly, you know, from the common law as stated in Hoops versus Hammergren. It's not technically a fraud claim, and I think it would be overreading Rule 9.
Is it essentially an intentional tort?
I mean, we've argued that it didn't have to be an intentional tort. That's the way that it was presented to the jury.
Their instruction was intentional. As I looked, right. I don't have it on me right now, but as I recall from reading the instructions, in order to get that breach of fiduciary duty, they were instructed that it was an intentional act.
Correct, Justice Silver. And we objected to that. We objected to the addition of the word intentional. I don't think that, the breach itself is an intentional act, but it doesn't have to be an intent to cause harm. Nevertheless, that's how it went to the jury, and I think the evidence supports that.
Let me ask you 30,000 foot.
Yeah.
I get the idea of analogizing doctors and hospitals, but what, if any, authority are you aware of across the country where states have accepted the idea of a hospital having a fiduciary duty to a patient? Because to my understanding, there aren't any. There are only 12, 13, 14, 15 that have said the opposite.
Well, we cited the cases in our brief. I apologize. including the Stamper decision from Ohio. This is at page 31 and page 32 of our brief. And they do talk about hospitals specifically, and they do couch it in terms of fiduciary duty. Now, I don't think that it is true that in many run-of-the-mill cases, there's going to be overlap between the duties that a hospital owes as part of its standard of care under professional negligence and the duties that it owes as a fiduciary of its patients. But those aren't exclusive. I mean, this court... Goldenberg.
Fiduciary duty has a very specific meaning in a legal context, and I think in your brief you acknowledge that these other cases don't use the word fiduciary, they just talk about various relationships that hospitals have with patients.
There are some that kind of analogize to it, and then there are some that actually use the word fiduciary. So I think I mentioned the Stamper case, the DiCarlo versus St. Mary Hospital, also on page 32 of our brief, that says nonprofit hospitals owe a fiduciary duty to the public with regard to staffing decisions. So there are cases out there, and again, this is an element of the common law. If Dr. Hammergren owed a duty to Ms. Hoops, I don't see how a hospital could not owe a fiduciary duty to its patients. Let me reserve the rest of my time for Mr. Polsenberg.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Stiglitz. May it please the court. Dan Polsenberg for the plaintiffs. You know, I think what the issue here is this professional negligence or is it something else? Whether we call it fiduciary duty or ordinary negligence, it doesn't fit the mold that it would have to be to fall under all those limitations under 41A. Let me chat just for a second about intentional, because we've heard a lot about that today. The breach of fiduciary duty does not have to be intentional. And in fact, we've discussed that. Justice Bell raised some issues about the verdict form. There's more than just the damages line. Yes, they put in the word intentional to our proposed verdict form. They asked for the instruction on intentional. The proposed jury instruction is at 3475 to 77, and I think the proposed verdict form, I'll give it to you in a minute. So really what we're looking at is something that is different from professional negligence. I think the duty is, just as Hoops versus Hammergren would say, patients come in and repose their trust and confidence in the hospital. Now, the real problem here is that the decision was not made in the context of medical judgment, diagnosis, or treatment. It was a business decision that was made and did not take into account all the time critical drugs that were out there. So I don't think we fall under 41A, and I don't think we have to prove intent. But we did clearly prove an intentional breach. Judge Bluth agreed. The jury agreed. So we have an intentional act here. But even if it were not an intentional act, since we don't have to prove an intentional act, we should have proven enough just to be a breach of fiduciary duty, something akin to ordinary negligence that would fall outside professional negligence. Now, Abe likes to call this a lesser included offense. Unfortunately, a lot of you understand that concept a lot more than we do, so I'm not going to say that. So what we're looking at here is, if we are looking at a fiduciary duty, it doesn't necessarily have to be an intentional breach, or it is an intentional breach, an intentional behavior, not intentional harm. It's different here from assault and battery. Did the defendants exploit? Yes. Did they know it was going to be this particular patient? Probably not. But they knew somebody was going to get hurt.
Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Again, looking at the two cases and distinguishing Hoops, assault and battery is an intentional act, correct?
Correct.
How do you liken that to this situation if you want to carve out intent?
And I'm saying it doesn't have to be that kind of intent. Right. It can be. I argued Hoops versus Hammergren. I don't think Dr. Hammergren intentionally breached the fiduciary duty. But this court didn't say it had to be an intentional breach.
Well, if I can just piggyback on Justice Perigier for a moment, how to take it outside of the medical malpractice piece.
Yeah.
Certainly leveraging a doctor-patient relationship for services, for sex, for money, something outside of the medical context, is more clearly would take it outside of this. When we evaluate what happened here, we're drawing a lot of inferences that may or may not be supported by facts in the record. That, for instance, the policy was developed by CPAs and not doctors, and that it was with a profit motive. Because if it gets down to just medication administration, we're clearly, it would seem, pushed back into this evaluation, this medical evaluation that kind of puts us back in the medical malpractice. So here's where I'm struggling with separating that out. And I know you're here, we talked about it in one context, you're talking about the damages. So before you go, even if you don't agree with us, even if you don't agree with me, just hypothetically, if the court finds that it is all one thing, I'd like you just to address what happens to the damages. Does that make sense?
Yes. Let me first say that I don't think that the decisions here, realize in cases like Hoops and Schwartz, the acts that were involved were after the medical treatment. I would propose here that the acts that were involved were the decisions, corporate decisions, that were done before the treatment. It wasn't the exercise of judgment. It wasn't the exercise of skill. Curtis points out that it could be judgment or skill. It wasn't either of those. It was a corporate decision. And I think Judge Bluth limiting it to the medication application procedure makes really this case a unicorn. This isn't the parade of horribles that we've heard about how this will affect everything. The decisions here were not professional.
But how would you distinguish? You want to get away from intentionality, and you want to say fiduciary duty can exist in this setting, but it's of concern to me. You're finding this based on an argument that the hospital wanted to not spend too much money so that it could operate without going in the hole or even at a profit. But couldn't that be true of a lot of decisions that a hospital makes that could be attached to the argument that they didn't have the best doctors in the world because the best doctors in the world are really, really expensive to put on staff? I don't see in the test you're proposing that anything that would provide any guardrails on what is a fiduciary claim against a hospital versus what's a professional negligence one.
And let's even take professional negligence versus ordinary negligence. What we have here is a decision that's being made not in the regular course. Abe already talked about how you don't have all the reviews and the approvals for all the other hospital policies. This was a policy that was brought down from the holding corporation, the parent corporation, and was adopted because of that. I think there's enough there for the jury to find that. Now, they say that there's conflicting evidence, but that's not how we view, a jury verdict.
Okay, you need to move to the damages, but I do have a question on those as well.
Yeah.
The lawyers for Centennial make the point that if you process through the verdict form, you don't get to punitives unless you get a yes on the
fiduciary. That's wrong.
Duty claims. So I would like to hear your response on that point, that only if there's a fiduciary duty claim allowed or sustained will there be punitive damages in this case.
Well, again, those are the changes that they have made to the verdict form. Question 9 said, did the employees of Centennial breach their fiduciary duty owed by La Quinta? And then now that was on our proposed. On the actual verdict form, question 11, do you find by clear and convincing evidence that the employees of Centennial engaged in conduct with fraud, oppression, or malice?
So, right, but you don't get to that unless you get a yes to 9 on the...
But 11 doesn't actually say it's limited to fiduciary duty. Negligent acts can be performed with oppression, fraud, and malice.
Sure, they can, but... On question 9, there's an instruction to the jury that if you answer no to the question of whether there was a breach of fiduciary duty, exit stage right, you don't go on to 10 and 11. And
but it doesn't say that 11 is based only on that.
It doesn't, but it does say don't go there. And in the case involving the
but the jury could have found here, the jury could have found on both, could have found punitives on both causes of action.
How could it have done it if it said if you go no to 9, you don't keep going and reach the punitives?
But they did say yes. So what I'm saying is the jury didn't have to, that this verdict form does not say punitives are limited to intentional breach of fiduciary duty. But let me say about the intentional breach issue, since all we need to prove is a breach, not an intentional breach, the fact that we proved an intentional breach must be able to let us recover under just breach, the point I made before about lesser included offense. So we're looking at malice, oppression, and fraud, and this is really why I say this is a good transition from what we have to prove on a breach of fiduciary duty, because malice is conscious disregard of rights and safety. Oppression is conscious disregard of rights. The imbalance of power, that is definitely what a hospital is. Justice Springer always used to talk about how it's the imbalance of power. I'm just about out of time. If there are particular issues you want me to address, I have them all here.
Does anybody have any other questions for Mr. Polsenberg?
Let me do, in 8 seconds, ratification and managing agent. The jury was told about managing agent. And look, let's face it, there's no doubt here about who the managing agents would be. It would be the people establishing policy. Nittinger versus Holman said a managing agent is someone who addresses policy as opposed to somebody who follows it. And we're talking policies here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Polsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'll pick up where Mr. Poulsenberg left off on the ratification point. There's an inherent inconsistency with their positions. On the one hand, they say this was a business decision by somebody else. But on the other hand, they say, but this was ratified by Centennial and you should be liable for punitive damages. Those both cannot be true. The evidence that we discussed, and I referenced it, is overwhelming that the medication administration procedure was a product of medical judgment. Again, Director Jackson testified to that. Nursing Director Jones testified to that. How it came from UHS, true, but it went through the policies and procedures committees, was approved by Centennial medical staff, again, 3234. And the only piece of evidence my friend Mr. Smith points to contrary that, I believe, is in response to Justice Silver's question. Well, what's the evidence that this was done for a profit motive? He is citing the letterhead for other policies, those letterheads saying, you know, somebody cited this, and the absence on the medication administration procedure, that's it. That piece of evidence that was not argued in closing is not substantial evidence in light of all the other testimony from Nursing Director Jones, Pharmacy Director Jackson, about how this was approved by Centennial medical staff. And again, it may have been negligent to not include this particular medicine on the time critical list, but that's still an act of medical judgment. The nurses themselves had discretion when in this window to deliver the medication. They had a window an hour before and a window an hour after. At 7802, the policy told the nurses to use clinical judgment. And they may have done that wrongly by giving it too early, but it was still an act of medical judgment. On Mr. Poulsenberg's point about this theory of intent, the theory of intent that Mr. Poulsenberg just described would turn almost every act that a doctor, nurse, or medical professional does into an intentional tort. Of course, doctors have intent when they do something, and that intentional act might lead to an adverse outcome, but that's not an intentional tort. Because I meant to give you this drug and a bad event happens, that's not an intentional tort. It occurred during the course of medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. I do want to address this, the pleading issue a little bit. That came up a few times. Particularly with the particularity related to fraud. And Mr. Creasy argued below at the summary judgment hearing that they were arguing a type of fraud which would require pleading by particularity. The district court's order at 6793 actually block quotes Mr. Creasy's statement saying that, no, this is a type of fraud, and that's where we get into whether that needs to be pled with particularity or not. And Mr. Poulsenberg tries to back away from the intent requirement now a little bit and saying, well, it can be negligent, that's enough. But Judge Bluth also recognized that throughout the entirety of the case, they were arguing this was an intentional tort. Intentional tort. That's why it's not capped. That's what Mr. Creasy said at the motion to amend hearing. That's what he said at the summary judgment hearing. The district court addresses that at 6797 of the record, saying this was argued as an intentional tort the entire way through the case. I'll address Justice Herndon's question about analogies to hospitals. And I think the case that addresses your concern, Justice Herndon, is actually from Arizona, Gonzalez versus Palo Verde. And the Gonzalez case there says there's absolutely no logic in the fact that doctors are subject to a standard of care, hospitals are subject to a standard of care, and yes, there are elements of a fiduciary relationship for doctors, but that does not mean there's a fiduciary relationship for hospitals. And that's what this case is about. I know we talk about doctors a lot, we're talking about a lot about doctor cases, but this case is about a fiduciary duty running to a hospital, and no court has addressed that. Mr. Smith talks about the DiCarlo case and a few other cases that do use the word fiduciary in them, but the DiCarlo case was a consumer class action, where uninsureds were arguing they shouldn't be charged as much as insureds, and that kind of springs from another problematic case that they cite, the Greshman case. Greshman is an old 1967, I believe, case from New Jersey. And the court there used the word fiduciary because a doctor was applying to a hospital. He wanted to get hired. They wouldn't hire him, so he sued. And they said in that scenario, you have a fiduciary duty in staffing. And from that one statement about a doctor trying to get hired, you get some of these other cases that the plaintiffs are citing about fiduciary duty, which are unrelated to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. I'll talk about the Hoops case a little bit here, and let me explain our position on Hoops. Hoops didn't involve medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. If for some reason that sexual relationship did have some therapy or some therapeutic benefit, maybe that would be covered by a medical malpractice case. That court kind of leaves that door open. But those facts are completely different than what we're dealing with here, that that was completely unrelated to medical diagnosis, judgment, or treatment. And there might be a claim there in that scenario, but if it arises from a therapeutic relationship, it's a claim for professional negligence. The court has said that in Montanez, the court has said that in Curtis, Zimborski. If it's a medical act from a therapeutic relationship, then it's most likely medical malpractice or professional negligence. The court has done that in other cases as well. I mean, lawyers are also fiduciaries for their clients, but the claim is legal malpractice. It's not a breach of fiduciary duty. The court said this in Stock versus Mushkin, that just because there are elements of a fiduciary relationship, that doesn't create a new, different, or separate cause of action.
Could you address the Mr. Posenberg's response to my questions about the verdict form and question 9, specifically whether or not absent fiduciary duty recovery and on this verdict form, they could go on to punitives premised on negligence?
Yes, Your Honor, I think you read it exactly correct, that the jury was told, if you answer no to 9 or 10, go home. We're done here. You don't even reach breach of fiduciary duty.
What do you say to Mr. Posenberg's argument in response to my questions?
Well, Mr. Posenberg is saying, well, the jury could have. I mean, he's surmising the jury could have found punitives just on professional negligence alone. From a legal matter, I'm not sure that's correct, but on the structure of the verdict form, that's certainly not accurate. Just like it's not correct to say that the jury could have reached breach of fiduciary duty in the first place if they had said no to questions 1 and 2 about standard of care.
Didn't the plaintiff, though, specifically object to that during the settling of the verdict form, right? So the plaintiff's proposed form does not require making the going to the end of the form if you don't check 9 or 10. And there was a specific discussion about that where the plaintiff objected.
You're right, Justice Bell. There was a colloquy at the Rule 50, their settling instructions. There was that objection, but the district court rightly recognized what you've been arguing for this entire case, pre-trial motions and everything. Your argument for punitive damages was based on the breach of fiduciary duty claim. So the district court rejected the plaintiff's attempt there to change that, given how the entire case was argued. But you're exactly right, Your Honor, that there was a colloquy about that. But I think the formation of the instructions was done correctly. So with my last 2 seconds, we ask that the district court be reversed, the court enter judgment against the breach of fiduciary duty claim, apply the 41A damage caps, and vacate the punitive damage award. Thank you.
Mr. Smith and Mr. Posenberg, for your excellent arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted. Court's in recess.